Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. In podcast 716 and podcast 717, I'm going to do it because I said I was going to do it, which is to lay out the competitive races for Congress in 2018. So this is the House of Representatives. I've done the Senate already, and I'll post a link to the Senate races so far in podcast 712. But I said I would do this for Congress. Now, I'm just going to tell you that doing this for Congress is extremely difficult because it's such a big issue. But nobody else is going to do it this way because I'm not picking sides and I am not grinding a partisan axe. I'm observing this, and as I have outlined in some of the other podcasts from where I stand today, I feel as though I'm able to finally look at this stuff from an objective standpoint. I certainly have my biases, one of which, and primarily, is individual freedom. And I'm one of these zero-based government people, which, I think if we say we don't need a government, then we can really start thinking about what it is exactly that we need. That is very pie in the sky, but no, I am not, doing this for any particular candidate or party or even point of view these days. So that's why this is a little bit different. So we're going to start with a little bit of analysis, and then we'll start getting into these key districts in podcast 716, and I'll go probably up to the Midwest, and we'll continue it in the next podcast, podcast 717. So a lot of this podcast is going to be making predictions about the future and how much that irritates me. I can't stand it when they tell you what's going to happen before it happens. And for the most part, you are not able to make predictions about things. But I can make one prediction that will come true, and that is that at some point in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, it is going to be over 70 degrees. I still have snow in the front yard that is melting, and it's been sunny and beautiful, and most of the snow has melted. But I have these huge drifts and, where you throw the snow and where they've plowed that looks like a glacier at this point. But it's going to go away. When it gets over 70, people in Minnesota like to turn their air conditioning on when it's 65 degrees outside. And so you need to make sure that you get it checked. And this is where Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business comes in. Because when it comes to keeping all these systems working properly, you got to have somebody who can give you reliable service. That means Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. They've been doing air conditioning stuff for years. The thing with the air conditioning is, as I've said, the box can get full of debris. There can be problems. And if you haven't turned it on for a while, you want to make sure everything's working right so that you can save money when you're running the AC when it's 95 degrees outside. That's reliable service. That means Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go back four generations in Frogtown. What do they do? Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. So if you own a business and you want to turn the AC on so that your clients can be comfortable, you want to make sure it works as well. So once again, reliable service for your air conditioning needs. It is getting warmer, and they can come out and check it if it's at least 70. And when they do, just one more thing, if you are in the process of remodeling, building a new garage, putting in a new basement floor, you should talk to them about things like in-floor heat and other improvements because they can help you with that now in the summer. This is the time to ask Ryan about that. Ryan Plumbing at ryanplumbing.com. Once again, 651-224-4771 in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Now, I want to say a couple things about where you get the Bob Davis podcasts. You can always get them on thebobdavispodcast.com with streaming as well as listening to podcasts right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. So you go down to the blog, there's a play button, you can hit that and it'll start playing it. You can also subscribe to the feed right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. You can subscribe at iTunes. You can listen to it on Stitcher.com, blogtalkradio.com, Spreaker, at lots of different places, Google Play. And I want to talk about one in particular because I haven't mentioned it in a long time. TuneIn. This is a service that's similar to Stitcher, works great with Android devices. And guess what I just found out? So God forbid, some of you people who are concerned about surveillance will hate this, but apparently I am told that you can actually ask for the Bob Davis podcast if you have Alexa, and she will go find one and start playing it. So I'll tell you more about that going forward. Appreciate the likes and the shares and the favoriting and so forth on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for the donations for Mobile Podcast Command. Yes, I'm going out again at some point. I'm still working on business stuff, but when I do, it's going to be epic. So stay tuned for more info about that. Again, not predicting an outcome and refusing particularly to participate in the storyline buy-in. This is where people take a storyline and get traction off the storyline. It's going to be this or it's going to be that, and here's why I say this. And then, of course, the media can always say, we predicted this would happen, it didn't, and now that's the new storyline. So I think the key thing with all of this is, rather than trying to predict an outcome, look at what the analysis says and go from there. And it's also about refusing to participate in a storyline buy-in, as I have outlined. First of all, a lot of these races are going to change as events and time progresses. Election day is Tuesday, November 6, 2018. Many of these districts have primaries in May or June or August, and that is what is going to determine the contours of the race in that particular district. And it is only the end of April in podcast time. So there is an ocean of time for funding and for all sorts of potential stories, challenges, and crises that can happen that would change the character of the race, not to mention achievements, depending on who is the majority party or who the president is. These things can have effects on congressional races, although congressional races are shockingly local a lot of times, and it comes down to personalities and local issues, and where I think they're appropriate, I'll mention them. You can't predict when some event is going to happen that will change the details or the direction of a race, but things will happen, and they could have an impact on the House races. They can be local or they can be national, international stories, events, which move races one way or another all at once. Again, I'm going to say this, even though people constantly try and they give you the idea that they can, we have learned, and we learned it in 2018, you cannot predict elections. They are even more difficult to predict than the weather, and even more difficult to predict, you know, presidential races or Senate races or congressional races, because they are local. And what you're dealing with are probabilities, which may or may not be current, but even these kinds of predictions are right until they are wrong. So after every election, political analysts, political scientists try to analyze what happened, and then they develop all these new measurements that you hear all about, you know, in these various shows where people are screaming at each other on television, that have new descriptions about why things happened or why things didn't happen, and they may actually mean something or they may fall by the wayside. So that's a huge piece. Now, before I begin talking about these races, and I'm going to rush this a little bit, but basically I want to say, so the big storyline is Democrats are going to have a wave election and that they're going to take over the House of Representatives, you know, in 2018, which I'm sure upsets Republicans and probably makes Democrats feel triumphant. The bottom line is, out of 435 voting members in the House, the current Republican majority is 237 seats in the 115th Congress. The minority Democrats have 193 seats. There are no independent members caucusing with either party. There are no libertarian congressmen. There certainly are people who have are progressive congressmen. There are certainly people who have sympathies and so forth and so on, but they're all pretty much Republicans or Democrats. There are two independents in the Senate, and that's why I said that. The question in the midterm elections is whether the majority will shift to the Democrats. For a majority, you have to have 218 seats. The GOP currently has 202, and I'm going to talk about Pennsylvania, but if you include redistricted seats in Pennsylvania, they may have 201 solid seats. And the Democrats have 201 as well. So you have 31 official toss-up seats, or seats that they are calling toss-up, potential toss-up races. We're going to focus on the 31 races considered toss-ups and then a bunch of other ones, which I'll explain to you as we get to them. Of these, 27 are held by Republicans and 4 are held by Democrats. So this is, to a certain extent, The reason so many pundits say that the Democrats will retake the House in 2018 as the result of a so-called wave election. So if the Democrats do win a majority and they win, you know, 219 seats and they gain, you know, from 193, whatever the number is, that's not necessarily a wave election. Wave elections are historic. We had a wave election, I think, in 2010, and that was because primarily of Obamacare. So a lot of these Republican congressmen came into office at that time. So this wave thing is unique because it's a specific type of thing that only comes along every now and then. It is, however, possible that the Democrats could win the majority in the House, but the devil is in the details, and we're going to get into that. First of all, and this is a problem for Republicans more than Democrats, there's a lot of redistricting going on in Pennsylvania and to a lesser extent in Florida. The state Supreme Courts have stepped in and redistricted because of lawsuits, and as a result, Pennsylvania, honestly, Pennsylvania is virtually unpredictable. In fact, I'm going to skip some of the key districts in Pennsylvania because, you know, as I looked into this and started doing the research for it, I did all this analysis on each of these districts in Pennsylvania, and then I realized they were all new districts and, you know, certain people are moving around and some people are going to have to, for instance, Connor Lamb's going to have to run again. He just won a special election in Pennsylvania's whatever it was, 17th or 14th district, and now they've redistricted, so he's going to have to run again. Districts have changed. Incumbents are moving and retiring, and it's a mess. But in some places, there is this is the other thing. In some places, California, Pennsylvania, you see it all over the country, there are just too many Democrat candidates. And so what's happening is now in states where they have something called a top two primary, like California, it is possible that the Democrats could cancel each other out to the extent that the top two candidates are Republican and there will be no Democrats running. So look for news stories about that and look for attempted legal action to address that by the Democratic Party. Or there are so many Democrats that they will literally, expend all of their resources on primary contests in their own primary, and they will be in a struggle when the final actual election takes place. Now, this is especially true in districts where Republicans are running unopposed in primaries, and there are like seven Democrat challengers. The second thing is, I'm not going to go through and describe the situation with seven or eight Democrat challengers, most of whom you will never hear from again. Again, depending on the state, like California or wherever. We're going to move east. We're going to move west to east, rather, and we're going to cover as many of these so-called toss-up districts as I think we should, and it's going to take two podcasts. So, and I don't – first of all, the thing that's interesting about this is that I've driven through most of – I've been to most of these districts. That's what I think is pretty interesting. So there's that. But the other thing is I think it's important that there is in one place something that you can listen to that lays out all these key toss-up districts, especially if you're a political junkie, because this is all so polyglot and so actually polyglot's not the word, but it's so diffused and so like puzzle pieces on these shows and people write about one district. And so you have no place to go to listen to the whole thing and go, now I know where the key races are and what's going on roughly in those districts. Nobody does that. If you want to sit and read the Cook Political Report all day, and then when you try to go into a district to find out where they got the data or anything, it's behind a paywall, that kind of stuff. I'm just going to do this. I did it for myself. So now I have a clear understanding of all these congressional districts, and I'm just going to share it with you. That's basically the extent of the analysis. And obviously, with you being told and me pledging that this is not a partisan analysis of how things are. Now, I certainly have some ideas about what I think. You know, you're going to hear in a few of these races, you're going to hear me talking about how I don't see where they've get this as a toss-up. But that's my opinion, and you'll know that. You can choose. If you think it's a toss-up and you think I'm full of crap, then that's fine. You know, but I'm not going to sit there and give you a Republican talking points or Democrat talking points just to, you know, try to convince you that things are going to be rosy for either party. So the close of the next podcast, podcast 717, is going to include the districts which are, quote, unquote, open seats. Actually, they are open seats where Hillary Clinton defeated Trump and the incumbent is retiring, or the district has had its lines redrawn by the courts and the incumbent is retiring or has to run again, because this is the essence of where this wave thing is coming from. But I don't know that you can say it's a wave if these are districts that have been redistricted with fewer Republicans or fewer Democrats, et cetera. So I'll get to that in the next podcast. So we're going to begin in the Golden State of California, and we'll start with the 10th District. This is Modesto in Central California, California's Valley, Stanislaus County. This is the sixth largest agriculture-producing county in all of California, which is a pretty big deal. They do wine and nuts. The Central Valley is home to many Republican districts, something that you don't think about when you think about California. The 10th District is represented by Jeff Denham, who just introduced a bill making it illegal to kill a dog or cat for eating. There's going to be a primary in early June. Denham has raised more money than any of his Democrat opponents. See what I'm saying about calling this a toss-up? And there are several Democrats vying in the primary, which could diffuse some of the Democrat votes and money come November. This is also a place, and the kind of place, where I would say immigration stories might play bigger or not, and because they've been dealing with this for so long, but so will ag issues, especially water. There's a big funding for a dam issue and local development issues, which may end up being bigger issues than the quote-unquote national media issues that you hear so much about. So why do they consider this a toss-up? They consider the 10th District in California a toss-up because Hillary Clinton took the vote in this district in 2016, and Denham's last election was close. Denham took the district by 3.7% of the vote. So that's a little bit better than some of the people who really are in toss-up districts. But, I think the fundraising and I think the fact that he is a little bit hard to pin down on conservative issues might have a factor in this. They are saying this is the one to watch because Democrats have decided that the seat is vulnerable. This is another thing that you see again and again and again. The National Democrat Congressional Committee says, hey, this is a vulnerable seat. We're going to target it. And so all the analysts call it a toss-up. Well, sometimes they are, and some just because they're going to target it doesn't mean it automatically becomes a toss-up. And they're saying it's a toss-up because Denham backed a repeal of the ACA, which didn't happen, by the way. He's another one of these Republican congressmen who tepidly supports the president, takes relatively moderate positions, and keeps his head down. There are no polls available in most of these races to give us an idea of how the race is going. So saying it's vulnerable at this point, I think, is wishful thinking by someone. We're just going to have to see where things end after the primary. And this is true with most of the races in California. So let's move south to Ventura and Los Angeles counties. In California's 25th district, currently represented by Stephen Knight, first elected in 2014, he is a former state assemblyman and state senator, police officer, and veteran. This is viewed as a plus-one Republican district. He defeated his opponent in 2016 by more than 6 points. So how is it a plus-one Republican district? See what I'm saying? There's also a primary on June 5th, four Democrats challenging with nobody running against Knight. He is a Second Amendment and an education supporter, pretty standard for Republicans. Also famously refused to vote for the president or Hillary Clinton in 2016, which I think is so California. And his strongest opponent, Brian Caforio, is also a pretty standard Democrat, supporting increased minimum wage, saving Social Security, pretty tame stuff. What makes it a toss-up? Well, Hillary Clinton won the district in 2016 by a 6-plus margin. And more importantly, the Democrats have made it a target for 2018. By the way, Knight won a 6-plus margin as well. Again, no polls, so we don't know what the situation is right now. And see, everyone reports this as a toss-up. Well, you know, the incumbent here, Knight, has raised an awful lot of money. He's got a good rep. He's a cop. He's, you know, a former veteran, all these things. So he's probably a pretty good candidate, unless there's something I'm not finding that's some horrible thing about him. So let's move on to California's 48th District, Orange County. This is Huntington Beach, Newport Beach, Southern California, 45 minutes from L.A., but a completely different world. So you hear on the radio, oh, this is close to L.A. This is not East L.A. This is a district, and it's, by the way, it's not West Hollywood either, where you've got very rich Democrats. This is a district Republican, Dana Rohrabacher, defeated Bacher, rather, Rohrabacher. It's hard to say his name, R-O-H-R-A-B-A-C-H-E-R, Rohrabacher, defeated his opponent by nearly 17 points in 2016. He's been serving in Congress since 2013 and was taken out and then came back. He is hard right on immigration, skeptical of global warming, but he also favors the legalization of marijuana, another So California thing. He supports withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. He has voiced strong support for Russia and Putin, which is weird. But he was also on Trump's list for Secretary of State. He voted against the tax cut bill because he wanted more protection for real estate. Here's the deal. This is one of the most conservative districts in California, certainly in the L.A. area, which in which a lot of very wealthy constituents live. You go to Newport Beach, you'll think you're in heaven. The average home price here is high, with a fair number of homes over $750,000. Tax and spend issues are going to be important. Immigration, again, maybe or maybe not. Russia and nuclear deals with North Korea and Iran. Here again, Democrats have targeted this district, but I'm not buying into the idea that because they targeted the district, the incumbent is quote-unquote vulnerable. I think the biggest problem is the number of people vying to win the primary on June 5th on both sides. If the incumbent loses here, then it becomes an open seat, and I don't think that's going to happen. Again, there's no polls to support any of this stuff, so that's another piece about California. Slightly northwest and inland, still in Orange County, is California's 45th congressional district. The incumbent is Representative Mimi Walters. This is a Republican district. It leans Republican. Walters has twice as much, at least, cash on hand as her strongest opponent. She defeated her opponent in 2016 by almost 18 points. If she wins in 2018, it will be her third term as a congressman. But here again, with a district in which Clinton won in 2016, we're going around telling people it's a toss-up. She won by 18 points, you know. So that would be a huge turnaround. That's right home to mom about. I don't see as an unusual thing in California in 2016, the fact that Clinton won the district, nor do I see it as a reason to say a race is competitive simply because the National Democrats say it is. Turnout in the midterms will not be the same as what it was in the 2016 presidential race. I don't know who that benefits, unless they can make the midterm about Trump, which they're trying to do. But even then, I don't know if that makes any difference because, again, local issues and personalities drive it. And again, this is Orange County, which is largely a Republican area. Walters has been serving in various capacities for a long time. Certainly, she has the resume as well as in the corporate world for a long time. So, you know, again, a standard conservative, opposed to abortion, solid on Second Amendment rights and so forth. Perfect for Orange County. No polls yet. So you attack a person, you look at a person or take a person that won their last election by 18 points and turn around and call it a toss-up because Hillary Clinton won the district. And because you think that the Mo is with Democrats because they're the loudest, I don't know if that's true. And without polls, you really can't say. Okay. Well, a lot of coverage of politics is telling stories. And, sometimes it's, not very extraordinary. It's just politics. But if you listen to podcast 711, this is the interview I did with Sal DiLeo. This is actually an extraordinary story. Sal DiLeo is an inspirational speaker and author. His story, as told in the book, Did I Ever Thank You, Sister, is the kind of a story that you don't hear too much these days for various reasons. Sal was taken away from his mother at a very early age and taken to this orphanage with his two sisters and brother. And he has an amazing story. It's really an epic. And of course, if you want Sal to come and talk to your group, once you hear this interview, you may want to do that. He does a great group speech, and you may want to get the book, Did I Ever Thank You, Sister. To do that, all you have to do is go to saldileo.com, S-A-L-D-I-L-E-O, or click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, saldileo.com. And again, the banner's up there. And I will give you Sal's cell phone, and you can call him. He doesn't mind. Does a lot of free speaking, 612-382-3582, or go to saldeleo.com. A lot of detail in the interview, but there is a lot more detail about his experience and his life at the orphanage and later at Boys Town and his experience after in the book. So check it out, saldeleo.com, or call 612-382-3582. This whole thing can get very confusing because you're dealing with all these different districts and everything else. I think the main thing that I want to get across is you can just listen to it and then you'll have an idea of a view of what's going on from 30,000 feet. You'll know where the issues are. You don't have to remember the districts or the names because you can't, but you'll get an idea of why a lot of the analysis is fractal, like puzzle pieces that have to be fitted together. And you don't ever hear about it in one fell swoop, which is why I'm doing these two podcasts. The other reason I'm doing these two podcasts is because this is a baseline. So I can come back after the primaries, and I can say, here's where we're at now. And you're going to see some of these races move from toss-up to Republican or Democrat as the actual tactical battleground for the 2018 midterms gels. And, you know, we're not there yet. We have a lot of people making predictions, but you know, that's it's one of the worst things about media, and it's unfortunately they don't investigate. And I honestly, I'm not sure that a lot of anchors or reporters are even bothered to do what I do, because let me tell you, I'm half asleep because I've spent the last 2 days doing this. This is really detailed work, and even for me, it's hard to remember which district I'm talking about. For example, I thought this was Oregon's first district I was talking about, and I'm going to talk about next. It's actually Oregon's fifth district, and this is a district that Democrat incumbent Kurt Schrader won by 10 points in 2016. Now, here's where we're going to talk about pivot counties. Why is this suddenly a toss-up? It's a toss-up because of something called a pivot county. And in this case, it's Tillamook County. This is a district that includes Lincoln, Marion, Polk counties, Lincoln, Oregon. This is a beautiful part of the country, an incredible coastline, one of my most favorite places in the world, parts of Mount Hood. It's really stunning. And to the east, you get into a little bit more conservative. To the west, by the coastline, you have a little bit more "quote unquote" liberal or left. But those people, I would say, they're more libertarian than that. I think the environment is an important part, obviously, of the district's concerns. Oregon is a strange place to begin with for a lot of reasons. The district leans Democrat. The reason they're calling this a toss-up is because of Tillamook County, which is what's called a pivot county. These were counties that seemed predictable in 2016 that had voted Democrat for Barack Obama, twice. And then in 2016, they flipped and went to Trump. So now they're calling these pivot counties. So Tillamook County, if it continues to be basically for Trump, could conceivably throw the district to a Republican. So this is one of the few cases where you have the Republicans viewed as being at the advantage potentially because of the pivot thing. Here's the thing about the pivot county thing. We don't even know if that's true. We knew that it's just counties that flipped for Trump. That's all it is. If that's going to be something that's going to continue, if pivot counties can be something that continue after the midterm, then fine. But we don't even know if that's real in terms of this pivot county idea. It's just a theory, I think. So that's my sort of half-ass prediction or not prediction regarding Oregon's 5th district. In Washington's 8th district, Washington State's 8th district, you have an open seat, and this is where they call them toss-ups because it's an open seat. This one actually is a toss-up for a couple of reasons. The candidates that are running are tainted in one way or another. So on the Republican side, you have a guy named Dino Rossi, who is a somewhat controversial former state legislator and Trump supporter. He has not won an election. That is my understanding. He was appointed to the state legislature, ran for governor. I think he ran for the Senate, didn't win. Because of the weakness of Rossi and because it is an open seat, it is viewed as a potential pickup for Democrats. However, the Pivot County question might come into play here as well because of Rossi's support for Trump. Over in the eastern part of Washington is the 5th District. This is where Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican serving since 2004, is running. I really don't know why they call this a vulnerable seat. She took every county in the district by good margins, beating her opponent by 20 points in a state where Hillary Clinton took it by 20 in 2016 by double digits. So why would you call that a vulnerable seat? You know, because I suppose they figure that there won't be turnout being driven by Trump. But, you know, that's, an interesting question. It's the eastern part of the state of Washington, which is the more conservative side of the state. Okay, we don't need to belabor that. In Nevada, the Silver State's 3rd Congressional District is a place where incumbent Democrat Jackie Rosen is running for the Senate and giving Republican candidates in the race Dean Heller fits. So the 3rd Congressional District seat is up for grabs. It has seesawed back and forth between Republicans and Democrats for a while. The primary is in June. The front runner there is Danny Tarkanian, who was defeated by Rosen in the last congressional election, but was encouraged by the president to quit the Senate race and run for Congress instead to give Dean Heller some room. Philanthropist Susie Lee is running in the Democratic primary. So where is this? It's South Las Vegas and most of the unincorporated Clark County and Henderson area. No polls, but of course, because of the swing characteristics of the district and because Tarkanian was defeated in 2016, they considered this a toss-up. And of course, Hillary Clinton won the state, won the district here by roughly 2 points in 2016. So Utah's 4th Congressional District is represented by incumbent Mia Love, who I'm sure a lot of Republicans are familiar with, who has been serving since 2015. There are 4 Democrat candidates ready to take on Mia Love in 2018. Remember, we're in Utah, which, by the way, she won by close to 12 points. In 2014, she won by 5 points, so she's been getting better. She is a standard Republican with nothing really out of the ordinary for a Republican in her voting record. She's a powerful speaker and has been featured at Republican conventions, a national personality, of course, and part of the largest group of Black Republican members yet. She endorsed Marco Rubio in 2016, so she's not necessarily a Trumper. Trump won Utah by almost 15 points in 2016, and I think he did very well in this district. So I don't know why they have this as a toss-up. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me. Lots of noise in Texas with the recent poll showing Senator Ted Cruz in a dead heat on the Senate side, which I don't believe, by the way. There are 3 districts in the Lone Star State considered toss-ups. And I'll tell you why I don't believe it, because it's one poll and the other ones showed Cruz in a very good position. So I'm withholding judgments on that one. But that's the Senate. You can listen to the Senate podcast and hear more about that. There are 3 districts in the Lone Star State that are considered toss-ups. We're going to start with Texas's 23rd. This is a huge district that runs from the western outskirts of San Antonio all the way to the eastern edge of El Paso. So it's all along the border down there. Not a lot of people along the Rio Grande. And we're talking about all the way down through Big Bend National Park. This district is 68% Hispanic. Hillary Clinton won this district narrowly in 2016, but so did incumbent Republican Will Hurd. It's the 9th largest district geographically in the U.S. Hurd won the primary in the district earlier this year by something like 60%. He's going to be running against Libertarian Ruben Corvalon and the winner of the Democratic primary. What makes this race close is the fact that Hurd won in 2016 by a thin margin, and the swing nature of this district also comes into play. It's been Democrat, it's been Republican, and we might want to watch closely to see if the Libertarian siphons votes away from the Republican. Hurd is pro-Second Amendment, voted to repeal the ACA, which again did not happen, and votes in favor of the U.S. energy independence, which of course plays well down there, and against civil rights protections for gays and for targeting terrorists. He voted for that. But oddly enough, no position on immigration. In this district, which borders Mexico, the immigration issue, you know, I'm not sure. I'm going to go down there at some point, and I'll let you know whether I think that it's the immigration issue is actually an issue significantly or not, because it can cut both ways. Here's another one of these national issues that people say, oh, this is what it means. You know, and in the districts, these national issues can sometimes help or hurt front-running candidates if they pick the wrong time or the wrong way to talk about a national issue. In the primary, you have a traditional moderate Texas Democrat running against an Our Revolution Democrat. The winner of that race is going to have a lot to do determining the contours of that race going forward. We're going to talk about the Texas 32nd. Pete Sessions, serving since 2002, is the incumbent in this race, winning the seat in 2016 by 71%. This is North Dallas, basically Arlington, around there. This is a district in which Hillary Clinton scraped by in 2016, 49-47. But when you look at Pete Sessions' performance, how is that a toss-up? You know, and then let's talk about the 7th Congressional District of Texas, a horseshoe-shaped district that extends from West Houston, west to Barker, north in a thin band to almost Cypress and Harris County, and then east into North Houston. These are Republican areas, although it should be pointed out that the party differences run strongly along racial lines. Blacks and Hispanics tend to favor Democrats, whites, of course, Republicans, and this part of Texas has a history of swinging back and forth between Republican and Democrat, you know, representation. As does Houston proper, one of the fastest growing metros in the United States. So if there's more Houston metro and there's a racial component, then that's the reason tactically it could flip. By the way, Houston city government has term limits, which might contribute to the volatility or not. I don't know. Incumbent John Culbertson has been serving since 2001 and won the last election by 12 points. John Culbertson, serving since 2001, and again, he won his last election by 12 points. There is a Democrat primary on May 22nd, and what's unique about this is that the National Democrats have taken sides against an activist, socialist, but she's an Our Revolution writer named Linda Moser, because they think she's too far left to win in that district. So they released a trove of opposition research on her, which has infuriated her. Signs of quite a split between moderates and progressives in the Democrat Party. I don't know how you end up with a toss-up when they're fighting amongst themselves. And this is going to come down to, you know, whether or not a lot of Democrats turn out. And by the way, no polls exist for a lot of these races. And when the polls are done, they may or may not be very reliable, because they're congressional districts and sometimes local, very local newspapers do, and they don't do a good job, or some weird political firm, or it's internal polling. So a lot of this is conjecture, or because someone's criteria was met for calling a race a toss-up, which is a guess. We don't even know what the criteria for calling something a toss-up is or not. I think a lot of these characterizations are actually premature. So we're going to move across the Midwest in the next podcast, podcast 717. This is podcast 716, so this is pretty much the West to Texas, and we're going to get into Nebraska and Kansas and Minnesota, and there's some very interesting races across the Midwest and East in 2018. Trade protection is definitely an issue in elections. One, you know, Paul Ryan's district, which I'm going to talk about in the next podcast, podcast 717, very much a trade protection kind of issue, and there are various effects. None of that matters if you're in manufacturing or if you have the company that manufactures stuff overseas. You're starting to think about reshoring for various reasons. If you are, there are definitely reasons to manufacture in the U.S., definitely reasons to manufacture in Minnesota at DepoStar, because they do a lot of electronic stuff. They do a lot of, and they do regular stuff as well, but they're great. They are on it. DepoStar, American Design, Engineering, and Manufacturing. Visit their website at DepoStar.com. DepoStar, DepoStar.com. Don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Real simple, your AC is going to get turned on very soon, and when it does, you got to make sure it works and that it's efficient, because you can lose a lot of money in the summer running that AC at home or business. You want reliable service? That's Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at RyanPlumbing.com. So thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 716. See you in podcast 717 to finish this analysis out. Boop.